Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and hosted by Eli Mazur. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app, share it with others, and leave a 5-star rating. And if you're not already a regular IP Watchdog reader, check it out and sign up for the email list to get daily updates. This episode features an interview with trial attorney Frank Jicks, the founder of the Intellectual Property Group at the firm of Johnson Pope in Tampa, Florida. There's a good chance that you have recently seen him questioning Joe Exotic in the Netflix documentary Tiger King. However, even before successfully representing Carol Baskin in Big Cat Rescue, Frank Jicks was already a legendary trial attorney in Tampa who handled lots of cases involving high-profile parties and interesting personalities and won many millions of dollars in verdicts. Many of those cases involved a wide variety of IP rights. During this episode, Frank Jicks talks about what it takes to be a great trial attorney, what it was like representing Larry Flynt in a case involving a promise of a $1 million reward for proving who actually killed JFK, whether he ever feared for his life after the Tiger King case, and much more.
But you're actually the first non-patent attorney that I've interviewed. I've interviewed non-patent professionals, but you're the first, I guess, trademark attorney that I've interviewed. So I'm glad we finally get to do that.
We'll see how different it is
then. Yes, exactly. And I did see you had some patent cases, so I'll ask you about those as well. All right, so I guess the first question that I always start with, it's a little more specific, but do you remember when you first started thinking about intellectual property? How old were you? What were you doing at the time? And I guess, what was your opinion or the role that intellectual property played?
Well, my introduction to intellectual property came about when I was in college and was hired by the Federal Trade Commission. The project I got assigned to was the commission's effort to cancel the trademark Formica as being generic. And it was in that context that I was mentored by a number of fine lawyers at the FTC and learned a lot about trademark law, about genericism, and a rather unusual approach to cancellation, which at the time was very threatening to industry, so much so that they were able to get Congress to revoke the authority of the FTC to even seek cancellation of trademarks, at least for a period of time. I believe that's been restored. But that was the first time that I think I ever really focused on anything that would be more, you know, properly characterized as IP law. That led to a student honors thesis to allow myself to get out of college that was on that very topic, which was the FTC and generic trademarks. From there, it led me eventually to law school. I went to NYU, decided to focus a great deal of my time on copyright and trademark, and they have great programs at NYU. So that's really where I picked it up from there.
When you were at the FTC, did that inherently seem wrong to you, the fact that they were trying to cancel these brand names that these companies, I guess, owned and invested in? Did you have any feelings about that at the time?
At the time, it seemed perfectly logical because I, of course, worked for the FTC
and, okay.
And accepted the premise. The premise that the commission was adopting was that if you have a market which has very high entry barriers, and the argument was in the world of manufacturing plastic laminate, there are high market entry barriers. You can't just start up a company and make plastic laminate. But because at the time, the contention was, consumers use the word Formica as the common descriptive term for plastic laminate, it gave Formica an unfair and in some fashion, anti-competitive market advantage over competitors. And the idea was that drove up prices and also kept out competition. So, you know, as a young 19, 20-year-old guy, that sounded like a horrible thing and we were fighting the good fight. You step back from it and you start saying, well, was it that big of a deal that the government really needed to expend a lot of resources to chase it down? I'll leave that for the annals of history to figure out. It was an interesting case. I suspect the commission could have probably prevailed on the pure issue of genericness at the time. I since believe that Formica has recaptured its brand, and to the extent that is so, it's probably a pretty strong brand.
I know you said you decided to go to law school. Obviously, it seemed you had a pretty strong interest in IP law at the time. But I also read that you were thinking about becoming an actor in LA. How did you make that final decision to do law school instead of, you know?
Yeah, I had trained for probably 5 or 6 years to be an actor. I did not train to be a lawyer. That was not my plan. And of course, we know everything that we're going to do in life at age 18 or 19. So I got to the point where I got out of school and I was trying to get a job as an actor, auditioned for the fledgling Denver Center for the Performing Arts repertory company that was having its first season. They didn't have any work for me because of the shows they had selected. They said, come back, audition for us the next year. That seemed like too long a time. And so I eventually made the choice to go to law school after a year break working for a law firm, put acting on the side for a while.
Another question, I guess, you said when you make plans, life makes other plans. You were interested in IP law. When you went to law school, you ended up practicing IP law. But did you envision at the time, what were your long-term professional goals? Did you want to go work back for the government, or did you want to become a high-profile IP lawyer in Florida? Did you?
High profile. I think I was inclined to stay in the private sector. I don't think I had a strong burning desire to do public sector work in IP. The choice of Tampa was happenstance. I could very well have ended up practicing in New York, Denver, DC, but I, for personal reasons, my wife at the time told me that I should practice in Tampa. That's how these things happen. Coming back to Tampa, it was not exactly a hotbed of IP law. And that was back in a time where we didn't call it IP law. We, of course, called it patent, copyright, and trademark law. And most lawyers who practiced were registered patent attorneys. They added on the trademark and the copyright kind of because they can and extra work they could do. But when I started practicing, the impression I had was that patent, copyright, trademark lawyers were not particularly gifted in the courtroom. That was where I wanted to be. I wanted to be in the courtroom. I'd always found trial work to be very interesting, challenging, and gratifying to me. And so I melded the two together, the substantive area that I really enjoyed, which was the intellectual property side of it, and the trial work, which was really not being properly, I thought, exploited by most practitioners at the time. Now, I guess I'm happy to say there's a lot of great IP trial lawyers out there. Yeah. It keeps me busy.
I guess I'm guessing you have a lot of classmates who ended up staying in New York, and maybe some even became IP attorneys themselves. How do you think it is different practicing IP law in Tampa versus practicing in New York, maybe at one of those big firms or otherwise, I guess? Any thoughts about that?
Well, big firm practice is big firm practice. It brings with it a lot of restrictions and stressors. New York, DC, Chicago, LA, those are big ponds. And if you practice there, you're constantly competing. You're constantly fighting to get clients, to maintain clients. I think that there are a lot of practice stresses that come with practicing in a large firm, in a large pond. For me, Tampa is a, you know, it's a healthy size. You know a lot of your peers, and certainly in the IP area, you know pretty much everybody you're practicing with. That's good, that's bad. If you don't like them, it's bad. Pretty much everybody knows who everybody is and knows who's a straight shooter, who isn't. So I like that. I do have classmates who stayed behind in New York and are practicing IP law in a very big firm context. I look at them, they're doing well. It's probably not a trade-off I would have accepted lifestyle-wise.
So do you think IP lawyers are friendlier to each other in Tampa just because they know they're going to deal with them in that smaller pond, probably?
Probably lawyers are nicer to each other in Tampa than they may be in New York. Although, you know, my experience with New York lawyers, I've generally never had any problems with New York practitioners. Miami practitioners, maybe another subject. there are certain geographic environments where I don't know what it is. It brings out the really aggressive adversarialness in lawyers that is not particularly tasteful, I think.
At least from my vantage point, where I only do patent work, I find like the variety of cases we handle so interesting. Is there a favorite type of IP case that you like? I know you obviously love doing trial law. That's a centerpiece of your practice.
Yeah, the favorite kind of IP case is probably the next one. You know, every case that walks in your door is going to bring challenges. Perhaps they're not going to be interesting to the public as some, maybe a former case, but they bring challenges. It tests your ability, I think, to sift through the issues and the facts that are unimportant and get to the ones that really are, and try to foresee how the case is going to unfold, where you want to take it, what your client's goals are, what you need to achieve in the case. Sometimes you're going to have a very fascinating issue of first impression, you know, whether it's an 11th Amendment immunity issue, whether it is a unique application of trade dress law, those types of things. You know, usually in every case, you're going to have something that you haven't seen before. And that's why you take the next case. And that's why it's interesting. I don't want to do the same thing over and over and over again.
I don't know if you've noticed the trend, but it seems that people are becoming more and more hyper-specialized. This type of technology, this type of patents for these type of clients. How do you think it shaped you as an attorney, the fact that you're dealing with such a variety? You don't say, everything is a trademark or everything should be a copyright case or and so forth. How do you think it shaped you as an attorney or your approach?
It's made me happier. So I think it gives you an advantage, perhaps, to recognize that there may be other answers to the question than the little box that, maybe some people want you to stay in. I try to practice somewhat out of the IP area in, commercial complex litigation from time to time, because I think it does allow you to think differently about the IP cases when you get them. I do think that is beneficial. I think specialization is inevitable. You're going to find people who are, because of their background or because of their interests, fall into certain very niche areas. I think I encountered a lawyer whose entire trademark practice was on craft breweries. I mean, the side benefits, the perks are probably great in that practice. That may be a little bit narrow for my taste.
In terms of being a trial lawyer, obviously you were an actor, so it seems it lands itself naturally to being a trial lawyer. But what do you think makes a great trial lawyer? I think you start talking about that. How does one know they have those qualities?
First of all, my view of trial work, it is different than acting. You're in a sense an actor. You're in a sense a script writer. You're in a sense the director. And your many other disciplines that are outside of more conventional performing arts. You have to be a psychologist. You have to understand people. You have to understand how a jury of people you've never seen before might react to certain approaches, certain arguments. You have to deal with your judge, who has a fascinating tendency to insert themselves in your case at inopportune moments. You have to know what a witness is likely to do, when is a good time to go hard at a witness to see if you can evoke a reaction that is a very positive reaction for your client's interest and perhaps a very negative reaction in the minds of the jury for the witness's position. So it's a multifaceted opportunity to craft an entire story, because fundamentally trial lawyers are storytellers. You're telling the story of your client, whether you're plaintiff, whether you're defense. You're telling the story of why we're here and why the outcome should be the way you're going to advocate in the closing argument. But by doing so, again, you are trying to meld together various witnesses. You're trying to anticipate what the other side is going to do to you. And you're going to have to be always under the spotlight, because as you sit at counsel table, as you may or may not be aware, the eyes are always on you. I mean, if you have a client who is making enormous negative facial reactions, the jury might not like that. I know judges often don't like that. You get called out sometimes. So you have to be constantly aware. It's a really fascinating process. It's a great process. Big fan of jury trials.
So I think you listed about 20 different things that you need to do, but how does a, and NYU law student know if he really should pursue becoming a trial lawyer, or, you know, he's better sitting in his office and reviewing documents or drafting documents.
Is anybody better sitting in their office reading documents? I really think most lawyers fall into two types. There's going to be the commercial type of lawyer and the litigational trial type of lawyer. And that's a personality issue. Some people like the process of building and putting together things, which is more of perhaps an office practice, a commercial practice. I like the process when there's conflict, not because I like conflict. I'm actually incredibly conflict averse, but I like to try to solve the problems that have led to the conflicts that were presented. So you just got to figure out yourself. Are you a presentational type of person? Do you like the opportunity to talk? Do you like the opportunity to persuade? Is it an uncomfortable thing for you? If it's uncomfortable, maybe you should think more on the other side. Do you enjoy the idea of creating? And then, you know, maybe you should be a patent prosecution lawyer who visualizes the problem and puts together the claims in particularly unique and hopefully all-encompassing ways. So you have to know yourself.
So I think what I hear you saying is it's most important to figure out what you like, and that kind of will make you the best attorney. I guess another question that I have, let's say you decided to become a trial attorney, you're about to have your first jury trial, and they come to you and they say, Frank, give me one piece of advice. I don't have room in my brain for anything else. I guess, what would you give them in terms of being in that courtroom?
Jump off the cliff. Do it. Do it. Because you could come up with 1,000 reasons to shy away from it, to try to avoid it. It can be pretty frightening, especially your first one. I was desperate to get in the courtroom, and I took a CJA criminal appointment. I had no business being in a criminal courtroom. But what I learned pretty quickly is the quality of representation was easy to catch up to. And the skills are transferable, and the opportunity was there. It was frightening for a 24 or 5-year-old lawyer to go defend somebody who was they were trying to send away for a long time. And you just jump in. I would say that's my biggest recommendation. If you're going to be a trial lawyer, do it.
Great advice. I guess from the other perspective, and maybe not even for just a trial lawyer, but let's say you're a business owner and you're thinking about enforcing your IP rights. What advice would you give about finding the right IP attorney?
You know, it's a good question, because I think consumers, whether you're a business owner or just Eli or Frank, finding the right lawyer is a very tough thing if you think about it. I would lean on referrals, because I do believe referrals get you typically to the better people. Find out, you know, who the best lawyers are that you know or can find, and ask them who's the right person to talk to in this area. And I think most of my work comes through a referral network, and that's what you build a practice on, your credibility on, and your reputation on. So it's not an easy challenge. There are resources, as we know, whether, you know, it's INTA for trademark law, whether it is the U.S. Copyright Society for copyright law, whether it is ALIPIA for patent-oriented work. So I just think it's referral-based. I think you're going to do your best by reaching out to people that can lead you to good lawyers, that lead you to the right lawyers for your particular problem. I don't think you go to a phone book. I don't think you go. The internet can be helpful, but it can be tricky. So I would be more focused on referrals.
Let's say you refer to somebody. Is there anything you could do to kind of figure out, will they do a good job of handling my case? You know, should I look at what cases they handled before, talk to their previous clients, see how nice they are to me, or maybe see how mean they are to me to see how mean they'll be to the other side.
Well,
that's comfort level, I guess.
Yeah, it's a good question, because you and I may not have been consumers of legal services. I have. What I did when I interviewed lawyers was to ask them hard questions to see how they would react. And one of the hard questions I asked was, You know, if I told you to, would you go after the other side and inflict pain, punishment, and make the case, you know, miserable for them? And the lawyer I chose was the one who said to me, no, I wouldn't do that. Okay. I wouldn't do that for the sake of doing that. Yeah. Now, there are certainly consumers out there that's what they want in a lawyer. I guess there's a lawyer for everybody, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. And because, I mean, part of your job is advising clients when to settle or when to go all out. So it's a kind of a judgment call that you have to make. And I was going to talk a little later, but I guess, how do you think about the legal system? You know, is it, how do you weigh whether to go to trial or to settle? And how do you advise clients about that who seem to have their own ideas?
If I'm handling a contingency case, and I do, I'm very, very careful with choosing my clients. The last thing you need is a client who is irrational when it comes to the decision points about whether you settle, whether you go to trial. Ultimately, you don't control everything because the other side has to dance with you if you're going to settle. And there are many cases where the other side does not want to dance that dance. And that means that you have to be ready to go to trial. Every case I take with the expectation that there is a scenario where I will be trying the case. If you don't do that, you're not doing your clients a service. If you take a case because your client says, hey, look, I think if we sue this guy, he's going to open the checkbook and give us some money. And even though my case isn't great and there's some bad witnesses out there, I think we can do that. And those are the cases you watch out for as a lawyer. You say, that's not the right case, because you don't bring a case to settle. You bring a case to resolve in the normal course. And if you're not ready and willing to try it, it probably is not going to settle well.
Yeah, that's also good advice. I want to talk about some of your cases. You've obviously had a lot of interesting cases.
For a very young lawyer as I am, yes.
Yeah, to choose from. But one of your first cases was, I think you were 5 years out of law school. You represented a computer programmer who developed, I guess, a computer game based on the Wheel of Fortune. Tell us a little bit about that case. And I one of the most interesting aspects to me is that you decided to bring it as based on state rights and not a copyright infringement case. Can you tell us about that and how you made that decision as well?
Sure. The time frame was, I think, 1989. And at the time, that was when Nintendo was first coming out with its gaming system. It was the hottest toy. I had kids. They wanted that Nintendo gaming system. TV, the Wheel of Fortune was, and I guess maybe still is, one of those hot shows that some people watch religiously. Well, the client came to me and he was an aficionado of the Wheel of Fortune show and wanted to get on the show and was also a computer adept person and created his own program for Wheel of Fortune to kind of be a testing and a preparation apparatus.
Yeah.
And as he was doing it, he became more enamored with the idea of actually creating something that might be desirable and usable by other people. And he actually created a graphically pleasing and clear representation of the spinning wheel, which at that time in computer programming was a fairly difficult undertaking. We now live in a time where you can't distinguish whether graphics on computer programs are real photos or not. But back then, it was a huge feat. So he did get on the show. He went out to California, unfortunately lost in his competition on the show, but he took his computer with him and showed it to the producer there and said, hey, would you guys be interested in doing this? And they go, this is great, but we've already licensed a company to develop the computer game for Wheel of Fortune. Yeah. And sent him on his way to talk to the company, which ironically was out of Miami, Florida. Long story short, the company entered into a license agreement with the client because they'd been completely inable and inept at developing the spinning wheel graphic. So all of a sudden he's producing, you know, a IBM version, an Apple version, a Commodore 64 version. Then he gets sideways with the licensing company, and that's when he comes to me because he says, we've never gotten any royalties. And we've never were allowed to do the Nintendo version, and they just released a Nintendo version, and that was part of our deal.
And he was based in Tampa?
He was in Tampa, in the Tampa area. So, you know, look, it's luck of the draw sometimes, luck of the facts. So the opportunity of having the contract as a bit of a anchor for a state court action, because the, you know, the other side was going to be non-diverse down in Miami, allowed me to look at New York law, which was applicable to under the contract, and try to develop a misappropriation of business idea theory, because it was pretty clear to me the client had no resources to have a drawn out federal battle. It probably looked like a copyright case in terms of, you know, infringement of the code. Didn't really know whether the Nintendo version that was on the marketplace had used his code at the time, had a lot of suspicions. So we brought it in a state court context. The other side tried to remove it, got remanded back. So we were able to keep it and make it stick in state court, and were able to eventually track down the contract programmer, which was a British entity, and establish that they in fact had been given our code to develop the Nintendo version. And all of that led to a very nice seven-figure verdict for the client.
And I guess to you, it almost seems natural, but how did you end up even thinking about, you know, filing it based on misappropriation and contracts? Is it something that you always considered?
Well, it was a contingency case. So you have to look at these cases carefully, decide how you're going to get to where you need to get. The assessment that the client lacked resources drove a consideration of a state forum where I could control the speed of the case.
Yeah.
And to some degree, the costs of the case. And so I tried to make it fit that need and still get to the end game that we wanted to get to. So, you know, it's a lot of front end research. When you take a case in, you have to spend a lot of time thinking about where it might lead and not just simply saying, oh, this is a copyright case, file as a copyright case.
And I'm sure in this case, I think you've hinted at it, and in your other cases, you've dealt with opponents who kind of have deep pockets and endless resources to try to make your client give up. How do you think about that? And have you faced situations where, you know, one of these clients where their attorneys kind of try to, you know, drown you in motions and discovery requests? Have you dealt with situations like that?
Yes, you anticipate that at the front end. You know that in many cases, if the other side has greater resources, they're going to take the scorched earth approach. You factor that into your equation of what can you achieve in the litigation. Is this a litigation where the client has staying power? Is it a litigation where you as the attorney have staying power? Do you have the resources to match the opposition step by step in the litigation? If you don't, you walk away from it. If the client doesn't have the staying power, you walk away from it. I think a lot of younger lawyers who haven't had as many experiences sometimes take cases that they should walk away from. That's a hard thing to learn as a lawyer, to say no to a case. But if you don't, you find yourself in a bad place often.
I mean, in your experience, do you find the judges kind of identify when those parties with deep pockets are being bad actors, in terms of it's clear that they're not doing it because they're actually in trying to find out something out through discovery, or they want to get to the bottom of all these legal issues they're trying to kind of make the other side give up? Have you had any success being able to convey that to a judge?
It's going to depend on the judge. There are some judges who come from that school of practice. Remember, every judge hopefully was a practicing lawyer. If they worked for a large firm, if they were on the defense side, they may feel very naturally aligned with the defense lawyer. You have to see that. You have to learn that. You have judges that are more plaintiffs oriented. Yes, there are judges that, you know, can put you through your paces. You have to persevere. You have to have persistence and staying power. And if a judge is not going to be particularly favorable to you, you just got to tough it out and get to the point where it doesn't matter as much, which is the trial and the jury.
I want to talk about some of your patent cases I mentioned. Actually, my last interview was with Josh Malone, who was the inventor of the bunch of balloons. And after a long, I guess, psychologically exhausting battle, he finally was able to settle that case. But one of the things that he talks about that, and I think other patent owners, is that for most patent owners, it's not only, you not only need the resources, but sometimes it's almost impossible to find an attorney to take your case. Because as you mentioned, the attorney has to make the calculation whether it's feasible to win that. I mean, I guess what advice, and it's, you know, that computer programmer from Tampa, if somebody said that as a hypothetical, you'd say, you know, most attorneys would be skeptical, you know. They'd say he doesn't have the resources, or he's claiming he invented some Wheel of Fortune game. I shouldn't waste my time with this. But I guess two questions. One is, if you're a patent owner, is how do you evaluate whether you actually have something worth pursuing if you're a patent owner? And second is, how are you able to convince an attorney like yourself to take that case?
Well, in the patent world, I think the plaintiff's bar, if you're looking on a contingency basis, is discernible. You're going to be able to go out there and see who's been doing it, who's willing to do it. Those are difficult cases. I do handle patent cases. I don't prosecute patents, as you know, but I handle patent infringement cases. You know, there's going to be a handful of people that you can talk to. You've got to determine whether those people have the resources to bring the case. Now I'm speaking, does the attorney have the resources to bring the case? I generally like to make sure that my clients in a contingency setting have enough skin in the game. Because if they don't have skin in the game, they're feeling like it's almost a video game where they get to play litigant. And it's all on the attorney's time. Yeah. It's all on the attorney's bank book as he's hiring experts and stuff like that. So what I try to do is get the client to, you know, advance most, if not all, of the costs if that's feasible. And my time I put into it saying, look, you know, I'm going to make that investment and hopefully the return will be there in a year, 2, 3 years and make that happen. But coming back to how you find them, you use the resources, you talk to lawyers, you find out who they've heard that handles these type of cases. You look at the cases they've brought, you interview them, you find out whether they seem competent, whether they have the personality that appears to be the personality that you can work with, that they're the person that you're going to trust with your case. Because for patent owners, they're coming in, this is their child. This is their big thing, and they're entrusting somebody to handle it. I've inherited cases which another attorney started, and those are hard ones. A lot of times some bad decisions have been made and you have to spend the next part of the case avoiding those decisions. So do your work early, spend a lot of time on choosing your lawyer, be a smart consumer. That's the, you know, unfortunately not skills that every consumer has.
One of your cases I saw was you know, it was an interesting, I guess I wouldn't think of it turning into a patent case, but somebody, Epic Metals, I think it was a company that kind of put a bid to install sound softening equipment on the ceilings. They got outbid. Next thing they know, the company that outbid them basically copied their product and installed it on the ceilings. And this one involved utility patents. You know, a lot of patent litigation attorneys tout their technical background. You don't have a degree, a technical degree, but what do you think about that? Do you think it's better to have that specific technical background, or is it better to be an attorney who kind of gets a fresh look? I guess you can better relate to the judge and jury about how they're seeing things for the first time.
Eli, I may have a bias.
Yeah, but well, I want to know your viewpoint. Yeah.
Well, my viewpoint is that I can generally manage the technology. I can learn the science. I've handled patent cases from electronic photocopy chip cases to cancer cure cocktail formulations, where listening to the experts and the inventor talk about the invention almost made my brain bleed. It was so arcane, but you can get there. And, you know, I am a believer that the most important thing that the lawyer is going to do is going to be able to communicate with a non-technical person, whether that's a judge or whether it's a jury. So I think that's probably a paramount concern. That being said, you got to choose a lawyer who's got the willingness to dig down and drill down into the the field of art. And I rely heavily on the inventor, rely heavily on experts. And that's why each case is interesting. You get to learn a new field. You get to go to college again.
Yeah. Another case that stood out to me just because it was seemed to me a very Florida case was the Diamond Pool Products case that involved a design patent for an alligator sculpture, from what I understand.
It was a pool float for a thermometer in your jacuzzi.
Yeah.
So that you'd see whether your jacuzzi was too hot, or in your pool, a chlorinator float. And the design of the float was a very realistic looking alligator head. And yes, it's a very Florida case. The company that created the floats was out of Gainesville, Florida. So they were real fond of alligators up in Gainesville, go figure. But it was very realistic. It was so realistic that there were incidents where people saw the float in the pool, mistook it for an actual alligator, and called Florida Wildlife to come get the alligator out of the pool. So the case was interesting in the fact that it kind of fit into this mold of a young upstart company getting taken advantage by a well-established company, a larger company in the pool products industry. They had seen the floats in pool stores, were very enamored, saw that they were very successful products, and basically bought the floats, the client's floats, shipped them out to their Chinese manufacturers, and had them replicated. And when we got to trial, they tried to take the position that it was A, non-patentable because all it was an alligator head, and B, they tried to argue that because it was just a replica, if you will, of an alligator head, that they had not copied it. They just used the concept of a real alligator head, which blew up in their face where when we pointed out that there's a fingerprint in the alleged infringing product that was my client's actual fingerprint that he had mistakenly impressed into his mold when he created it. So they had actually molded from our client's product to create it. And it was one of those unique moments in trial where you just gotcha.
Did your client discover that fingerprint before they came to you, or how did that kind of come out?
He actually did. He knew that the fingerprint was there. It was a little bit hard to find it in the infringing product, but we had that and we held it in our pocket and they walked right into it.
Yeah. It's funny. That's like a watermark, you know, they have. That's
like with the old map makers, you know, they would put, you know, a river in the map that did not exist.
So that's a great technique that people are worried about infringement. So we'll get to your, I guess, most famous case right now. But before that, you've had other high profile cases that were a little more exciting than the average patent case. You represented Larry Flint at one point, after his movie People versus Larry Flint came out. First, I guess, how do you get Larry Flint as a client, you know, after you'd think he'd have all the...
Well, let me be very clear on this. It was not because I had a subscription. I don't even remember how they came to find me, but it was some type of a referral.
Yeah.
They were obviously California-based. It was a really, really peculiar case, and I have to obviously preface, it wasn't really an IP case. I was hired because Larry Flint was sued by an individual that lived in Clearwater for a demand of making good on a reward offer. And effectively, the plaintiff claims that he was entitled to a $1 million reward that Larry Flint had offered. Well, the problem was the offer that he wanted to accept was an offer that was made by Woody Harrelson in the movie People versus Larry Flint, where Woody Harrelson portrayed Larry Flint and has a moment where he says, you know, I'd pay $1 million to find out who really killed JFK. Turned out the plaintiff was one of these conspiracy nuts, and he had spent his whole life collecting information, trying to figure out who killed JFK. And so he shipped all that information off to Larry Flint, who promptly packaged it and shipped it back to the plaintiff. And the plaintiff decided he was entitled to his $1 million and sued.
And he was representing himself, I imagine?
He was representing himself, which, let me tell you, is not an easy thing to deal with. When the other when the other side is unrepresented, you'd think you'd have a laydown, but it is often the worst case you could ever have. And this was a difficult case, because what I tried to set up was a simple motion to dismiss the case, because it is not legally plausible to accept a reward offer from a movie you see on cable TV. That was my basic premise. I think we could have won that. But before we could have the motion heard, the pro se plaintiff decided that he was getting ramrodded and sued me, sued my firm, sued the judge, sued one of my associates, and then eventually dropped the case, refiled it in federal court, sued the federal court judge that got assigned, and then sued the entire Florida Bar Association. The theory that he actually sued me for was that I, Frank Jakes, was an accessory after the fact to the assassination of JFK.
I'm guessing he won that lawsuit, right?
Fortunately, I did. I'm not sure if that exonerates me. I'm pretty certain I was 5 years old at the time. I was in kindergarten. I was not anywhere near Dallas, so I think I'm off the hook. That was a pretty strange case.
Is there anything different about handling a case that involves a high-profile party or a high-profile client and how you approach it, or...
I thought you might ask that kind of a question. It's a hard question. I would say that the most significant element in a high-profile case is the way that you have to deal with the media. You have to learn the client's interests. You have to know whether the client is averse to media coverage, whether the client can use media coverage to its advantage, and how to best incorporate that media coverage to your client's interests. So it is a trickier thing. It's another skill set that a lawyer has to develop, is dealing with the public and media on behalf of a client. I think the first law firm I worked for was a very conservative firm where the mantra was no comment for any media inquiry. And that can be disastrous for a client, absolutely disastrous. But you also got to be careful what you say.
In my previous interview with Josh Malone, actually, he talked about it. For the first year of his case, he was terrified about saying anything outside of the legal documents. And then he realized that's the only way he's actually going to kind of get enough pressure going to settle the case. I mean, what is your advice? How do you use the media to help you in the case? Because, you know, in theory, it should be of the judge, you know, or the jury, not influenced by anything else that goes outside of the law and the facts, but I guess how do you use the media effectively?
I think you got to be careful if you think you're going to orchestrate what the media does. Be careful, because the media can bite you in the butt. So you have to be cautious. You have to decide what interests are you really advancing by using the media. Are you bringing pressure to bear on the defendant or the plaintiff, depending on your position in the case? And you have to read the media, what is the spin that the media is trying to put on the case. If the spin is the other side's spin, you have two choices. You either try to redirect that spin, or you decide that the better course is to say nothing, hope that that media overture dies down and does not affect you. So there's a lot of assessments that go on. I'm not a believer that you're going to bring somebody to their knees by a TV piece and a news article. I've been involved in media reports of all kinds. For example, in a class action context, you might need media to perhaps get some additional class members or class representatives. So it's a good thing to get the word out.
Now, I guess I want to talk about, for better or worse, your probably most famous case right now is related to the new documentary on Netflix, Tiger King, and you represented Carol Baskin and, I guess, Big Cat Rescue in their lawsuit against Joe Exotic. Well, I guess I want to start. Did you have a chance to watch the documentary?
I did. I didn't know it was coming out. My client had alerted me at various points that they had been working with the podcast, for example, or a documentary filmmaker, but I hadn't really followed what was going on. And the next thing I saw on Netflix was the Tiger King and that ever famous face of Joe Schreibvogel, as I knew him. I said, holy cow, look at that. So yes, my wife and I watched that. It was challenging. I had lived probably most of it. The latter part of it was probably more through just information that was provided by the client, but I certainly lived the front end of it. Then in episode 4, I'm watching and I see a deposition, Joe being taken. I said, that looks incredibly familiar. And then I hear my voice and then I see my firm's water bottle in the shot. It was a video deposition. So I go, oh, well, I guess my disembodied head is now a celebrity.
For somebody who hasn't experienced it, what is it like to watch a movie about something you were intimately involved with? And obviously, they didn't ask you to review the final cut to see what you thought about how things were portrayed.
I had no editorial, none whatsoever. It is, in many regards, painful. One of the other things you learn about the media is they often get things wrong. And when you're a lawyer, it just drives you crazy. And you really have no recourse, and often nobody cares. But it was painful to watch because you could see how the filmmakers and the editors had chosen to take the story and make it into a fairly salacious presentation, missing the real, at least from my client's point of view, the real issue of the illicit cub-petting trade and trying to end that practice, which leads to improper breeding of big cats in captivity. It was a real problem. It was a problem that my client has had as its primary mission as a not-for-profit entity. So watching them take this salacious, and goodness knows there were a lot of characters who were pretty salacious in this story, and make it into what they made it into was frustrating. It was disappointing. But I also saw that there were hopefully positive aspects that came out. More people now are perhaps aware of the problem. The difficulty is that the editing did not adequately portray my client and their charitable mission and their primary public service mission in the light that they intended.
You mentioned that deposition with Joe Exotic. You know, he seems such a almost a character, not out of real life. What was it like deposing somebody like that? Was it that kind of experience where you're like, what is going on? Or is he much more normal in that deposition room than that movie, I guess, made it seem?
I don't think the word normal is used often with Joe Exotic. and I don't think I could use the word normal. He really is the person that you do see in the Tiger King documentary. He is that much of an oddball. He's really quite different. From a lawyer's point of view, taking the deposition of somebody like that is, in some regards, a treat because you're able to allow this personality to give you stuff that a good, well-schooled witness is not going to give you. And the one thing you can be sure of is that he did not have the discipline to follow his lawyer's advice on shutting up. And so you would just get these lovely, lovely stories and admissions. And from, you know, a pure litigation standpoint, a pure trial lawyer standpoint, it was gravy.
How did you end up getting involved with this case? Do you remember?
They had heard about me and came and interviewed me and said, look, we think we have what may be a trademark problem. And they most certainly did. They had been battling with Joe for, you know, a few years before they came to me. And Joe, of course, is a prolific breeder of tigers and mixed breed big cats for the purpose of getting cubs that he can then take on the road to various shopping malls and places like that and charge people to pet them and to hold them for the limited few weeks that you can do that with a small cub. And what he would do is he would actually take younger cubs that were too young to be taken away from their mother and start taking them on the road. And he would also push the other end of the envelope where he would allow cubs that were too old to be in human contact or to be petted. And they were dangerous to the people who were being exposed to it. But once the cub loses that characteristic of being able to be a petted cub, there's no use for him. He becomes a big tiger that costs thousands of dollars a year to feed and is often mistreated or ultimately killed or sold for, you know, somebody else to have in their garage somewhere. So that was the problem they came to me with. The trademark issue was that the battle between Big Cat Rescue and Joe had escalated to the point where Joe was just so frustrated with Carol and Big Cat Rescue that he decided he would show them a thing or two, and he would name his traveling entertainment show Big Cat Rescue Entertainment. And so he would show up at these malls with his big semi-trailer truck with Big Cat Rescue, our logo, right on the side. Yeah. And everybody would think there was a connection between us and this cub petting exhibition that was going on. So he was just, you know, shoving it in the face of Big Cat Rescue, but it was a perfect, very clean, strong trademark infringement case. Yeah. So I said, you know, you got a great trademark case. I'm happy to bring it for you. We talked about the economics that it was a case that probably would not have money at the end of the rainbow.
That's interesting. So you kind of expected him to be judgment proof from the very beginning.
Yeah, we had no expectations that he had a bucket of money that he was going to be able to pay us. That, of course, proved to be correct. He kept dodging the collection efforts long after I'd gotten the judgment and was somewhat out of the case. But it was really a goal to get him to stop doing, A, what he was doing with Big Cat Rescue Entertainment and misleading people, but more importantly, could that be a vehicle by which they could advance their primary mission and perhaps even stop him from his cub petting and his breeding policies entirely? Ultimately, we see that in a very weird, long, roundabout story is exactly what happened.
I guess that aspect of the movie is accurate. It wasn't just about, I guess, enforcing the immediate IP rights.
Clearly, they were not happy that he was misleading the public and hurting their goodwill and their reputation. But yeah. The ultimate purpose was to bring light to the issue and hopefully make some headway and stop another prolific breeder, prolific cub petting provocateur to stop what he was doing. So that was clearly the client's goal. And you had to know that going in. And I did. And we knew that was our ultimate purpose. And so we handled the litigation in a way that would further that.
I guess one of the things is, it seemed like a clear trademark case, like you said. I just wanted to ask about your strategy a little bit. You decided also to file a copyright claim, and you did it in a federal district court, obviously, in Florida. And in Florida, there's a lot of, I know what you would call them, petting zoos or wildlife shows. And you think maybe people in Florida are sympathetic to what Joe Exotic was doing. Were you worried about that?
I think that issue is nationwide. I think there are people that are naturally attracted to big cats and the concept of petting them like they're domestic animals. I think that's a human instinct. It's a somewhat uninformed human instinct. I will disclose something that I'm not sure I ever even told my client at the time, but as a teenager, I actually worked in one of those roadside zoos that, that shoved all these, exotic animals into little boxes. And it was very distressing to me at the time, but, most of those roadside zoos have largely gone away over time, even in Florida. Yes, we have a lot of bad actors down here. And
I mean, I've been in Florida, and to me, until I watched the movie, I didn't realize, it was actually a contentious issue. But so it was. I learned a lot. But
yeah, you don't know these things until you're really faced with them. But and I honestly didn't know about the issue until the client presented it to me. I was not a zealot in the ethical treatment of animals issue or anything like that. The client comes to you and you try to help the client out. And it fortunately is on an issue that, I could philosophically get behind as well.
Yeah.
And putting this case aside, and I think you mentioned that Joe Exotic probably wasn't the best client to have. Let's say you're John Smith. You don't know anything about IP rights, but you purposefully, steal somebody's trademark or something like that. and then somebody sues you, I guess, what advice would you give to that business owner who behaved in that way, or that business owner's attorney? What do you do at that point? You know, you got in this, yourself in this mess. You obviously did something that was contrary to the law, but you just didn't know better. I guess, what do you do at that point? What advice would you give?
Mitigate, mitigate, mitigate. You try to extricate your client from the mess. You try to get them to stop doing the infringing act as quickly as you can. You try to immediately put on a white hat as best you can. Every case, of course, is going to have its own factual issues. To the extent that you have to litigate the ultimate question, you try to see, are there any potential holes in the plaintiff's trademark rights? Sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes, for example, if it's a common law case, you may be able to find somebody who has superior rights that you can get licensed to your client, the defendant, and perhaps play an end run. I've been able to do that in a couple of cases. So you do the best you can, but yes, you try to extricate your client, try to get your client to understand that probably the best outcome here is just to get out of the case.
And you know, it's funny because a lot of people confuse me with a trademark attorney sometimes, and they come to me with these issues.
I'm confused. For a patent attorney. Yeah. I know how you feel.
And I probably shouldn't admit that, but my advice is just talk to the other party and see if you can kind of sell it person to person versus getting like lawyers involved and all that.
Often that works. The difficulty you have is, does your client have the skills to talk it through? Yeah. What is your client going to say in the process? You can probably keep that out if it goes to litigation under auspices of being a settlement overture or something like that. But you got to be careful about that, of course. But yeah, look, a lot of trademark cases can be simply worked out. You can have legitimate competing businesses that, for reasons that are entirely reasonable and not ill-intentioned, have gotten themselves into an overlapping territorial battle or a brand name issue. And yes, they can be worked out. If you get your client focused on what is the real goal here, is the goal to spend a lot of money on people like me for 2, 3, 4 years of litigation to exit the backside with who knows what kind of an outcome, versus should you get back to your core business, make money in your core business, and simply find the appropriate, hopefully, win-win exit strategy, that's the way to go. And you're right, as a lawyer, there are lawyers out there, I hate to admit it, that like to foster a client's sense of indignity, of ire, that they've got to go out and get vindication. Well, that's really not what a lawyer should be doing. A lawyer should be assessing what the client's real interests are. And sometimes the clients get personally invested, sometimes they get emotionally invested in an issue, and you have to walk them back. You have to get them realizing that they're not going to be better after the litigation if they persist on that track, and that the real business is where they should put their focus.
You know, you mentioned that you've also handled some criminal cases. Obviously, the movie gets a little bit dark at the end. One, you're showing one. But as an IP attorney, you never think you'll have to worry about your safety. With this case, did you start worrying about that? And how has that experience kind of changed you, the way you think about cases and clients and so forth?
I didn't ever feel threatened, as wacky as Joe was, but my wife was very worried. We had just met around that time, and she was very concerned that he was more dangerous than just being wacky, that he might, a lot of times people personify the lawyer on the other side. They like to put a lot of focus on the lawyer. It's part of what we do, I suppose. But I didn't personally feel that way, but maybe I should have. The good news was I had handled the front end of the case where we got the judgment. I was not handling the collection side of it. So perhaps if I were the collection lawyer still, then maybe, you know, I would have been number two on the list. I don't
know. Well, I guess that's good. I guess before we move on, are you surprised how popular the movie has become? Anything else that stands out from this whole Tiger King swirl or experience, seeing it everywhere now?
I think the perfect timing of the release of that show, right as everybody was sequestering themselves in the COVID world. You could not have asked for a better timing. It was absolute brain pablum. People that were locked away. I will say there were a lot of very crazy people involved with that case. And I'm not speaking about my clients, who are very unique individuals too, but there just were a lot of very odd people. So it does not surprise me one whit that it's caught the interest of so many people in this time of sequestering. I wish that the ultimate message would have come through a little bit clearer, that the real goal here was to do something right for the animals. And I'm not sure that that really came through.
It's funny. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, somebody might say you had a real concern to worry how careful and whether you should worry about your safety or not. And this is something that a lot of people are thinking about now with the whole coronavirus thing, because it's really hard to, you know, measure, you know, you say you have 1 in 1,000 chance, how seriously should you take the kind of threat? Any thoughts about that, going through something like that, kind of this whole coronavirus?
I'm not sure I can quite draw an analogy between the Tiger King and Joe Exotic. But we all in the profession and everybody are trying to navigate as best we can, first to be good members of society and trying to do the right thing. And in my personal view, the right thing is what is good for society. It's not necessarily self-interest in protecting yourself from exposure. What can we do to knock down the whole thing society-wise? That's really my viewpoint on the role of an individual. But we're going to be dealing with the ramifications of this crisis, as everybody is acknowledging now, for a very long time. We as lawyers are recognizing the truth that we are service providers for our clients. That means for each and every one of our clients, we've got to learn what the impact is on that client. I have a client, Hard Rock Cafe, with their casinos, hotels, and their restaurants largely shut down. I have Ironman Triathlon, largely shut down. Then you have some clients that are able to continue operating. They're a medical manufacturer or something of that nature, and they're able to keep going. So we're going to be called upon to address and help our clients as best we can through the process. From our perspective, we're not going to get all the calls we used to get, because the clients are going to be more concerned about keeping the doors open, maybe reopening the doors, than they are calling their lawyer about a trademark concern or about filing a potential patent. So it's going to be some very difficult times for law firms and necessarily for our clients.
I guess on a practical level, how do you think judges and other attorneys are adjusting to this virtual world where it doesn't always make sense for people to make a court appearance or to do a deposition in person and so forth?
I may not be the best person to ask, because I have not yet had a court hearing during the period of restrictions. I've put off some cases and things like that. Had a number of depositions that we just canceled. They were out of town depositions. I guess theoretically we could have tried to do them with Zoom technology. I hear this Zoom technology is a thing now, but I have actually done that in cases for cost control purposes. But I don't know ethically whether, in the height of this, the right thing to do is to subpoena a non-party witness to show up, to travel on the subway or something, to get to a space where there's a camera and a court reporter, and they're being exposed to God knows how many people in the process, so that I can, through Zoom, in the comfort of my home, ask them questions or defend them. You know, I think ethically that would have been the wrong thing to do in this time frame. How we exit this process and start the real world of litigating cases again is going to be interesting. I don't have a perfect answer. I think there will be a lot more remote deposition taking. On hearings,
Can you imagine doing that with Joe Exotic, having him on Zoom? And
he would love it, probably. You put a camera in front of that
guy. I guess it would be natural for him, yeah.
You know, what was the old adage? The most dangerous place to be would be between somebody like Joe Exotic and hit him like that. I don't know. I think there are going to be a lot of changes. I think the courts are going to be a lot more conducive to holding telephonic hearings. One of the issues will be whether in actual trials or evidentiary hearings, the courts will allow teleconferencing of witnesses. You get into some, you know, interesting due process issues there. Obviously, on the criminal side, you get into, you know, Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause issues. But yeah, we're going to be changing a lot of stuff the way we do it. I think that law firms are not going to have the big offices with every lawyer having an office. We'll probably get into plug-and-play situations where you work from your studio there, and I work from my studio here, and we go into the office maybe once every couple of 3 days for whatever meetings or depositions we have to do. So I think a lot of things will be changing.
Okay, interesting. So I have two final questions, hopefully fun questions. What advice would you give to a law school student or a young attorney who wants to become the next Frank Jakes, you know, represent really interesting clients? What would be your advice?
Aim higher. You got to, first of all, decide that you want to be a lawyer in the sense of what that entails. I have three children. I did not steer any of them to the law. I think they all would have been good lawyers. I sometimes regret that because maybe they would have been very good lawyers.
Yeah.
And I think you have to decide that you enjoy the challenges, the intellectual challenges, the opportunity to solve problems, because we are so much a problem-solving practice profession. I think you have to be willing to endure a lot. The practice of law is far different now than it was when I started 35 plus years ago. But if you love it, if this is really the kind of thing that gets you excited, I think the next thing you have to decide is, what substantive areas do I like? And if it's patent prosecution, do it. If it's trial work, IP, do it. What I've always told, you know, younger lawyers, because somebody must have told me at some point, is the most important thing at the beginning of your practice is just be a good lawyer. If you learn the skills of being a good lawyer, nobody's ever going to be able to take that away from you at all. If you get fired by your law firm, you're still a good lawyer. You know, if you want to go out and start your own practice, you're a good lawyer. It's going to take many years to build up a reputation, a practice. This is a reputationally based field that we're in. It doesn't happen overnight, but you got to be credible. You got to be honest. You got to be pretty much reliable, because the people that you're dealing with one day may be referring you a case the next day. Maybe I've been at this too long, but there are any number of people that I have sued that later on hired me.
That's quite the compliment.
Or something. But so anyway, that's what I would say, is you've simply got to make sure that this is what you want to do. And if it is, you got to do it. You got to be fearless. And you've got to be fairly persistent, but be a good lawyer. Just be a good lawyer.
Great advice. And my last question is, if you didn't become an IP attorney, is there any other path that you think you might have liked to pursue or still might pursue?
I may open up a big cat zoo in Oklahoma. I'm always hoping for that.
So that's a takeaway, I guess.
You know, obviously, I came within a hair's breadth of being a professional actor. I don't think I probably would have enjoyed life quite as much if I'd done that. I am very happy with my life as a lawyer. Are there other things? Yeah, there are many other things in life to do, whether I do them as a side or, you know, after I stop practicing as actively as I'm practicing. Maybe I don't have an answer to you on exactly what that would entail, but yeah, there's a lot to be done yet in life.
Remains to be seen. All right. Well, thank you so much, Frank, for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Happy to. Eli, you have a great rest of your COVID incarceration.
You too.